Meanwhile, leading conservatives also began championing group blindness, although in a much more nationalistic, patriotic register. Ronald Reagan, who would become the demigod of this movement, emphasized both American exceptionalism as a city upon a hill and the values of rugged individualism, embracing equality of opportunity through free markets. While explicitly rejecting racism and even claiming the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., Reagan also rejected affirmative action and mandatory minority hiring. "We are committed to a society in which all men and women have equal opportunities to succeed, and so we oppose the use of quotas," Reagan explained. "We want a colorblind society, a society that, in the words of Dr. King, judges people not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." To be sure, many on the left claim that the right's rhetoric of colorblindness was always disingenuous. They cite, for example, Reagan's famous denunciation of welfare queens as a term loaded with disparaging racial overtones. Nevertheless, Reagan raised a flag of colorblindness around which the American right would rally for decades to come. Thus, in 2013, when President Obama said that Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago, Fox News radio host Todd Starnes was quick to label the president race-baiter-in-chief, and Newt Gingrich called the speech disgraceful. Perhaps in reaction to Reaganism, in the 1980s and 1990s, a new movement began to unfold on the left, a movement emphasizing group consciousness, group identity, and group claims. Many on the left had become acutely aware that colorblindness was being used by conservatives to oppose policies intended to redress historical wrongs and persisting racial inequities. Many also began to notice that the leading liberal figures in America, whether in law, government, or academia, were predominantly white men, and that the neutral, group-blind, invisible hand of the market wasn't doing much to correct long-standing imbalances. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, the anti-capitalist economic preoccupations of the old left began to take a back seat to a new way of understanding oppression. The politics of redistribution was replaced by a politics of recognition. Modern identity politics was born. As Oberlin professor Sonia Crooks writes, "What makes identity politics a significant departure from earlier pre-identitarian movements is its demand for recognition on the basis of the very grounds on which recognition has previously been denied. It is qua women, qua blacks, qua lesbians that groups demand recognition. The demand is not for inclusion within the fold of universal humankind, nor is it for respect in spite of one's differences. Rather, what is demanded is respect for oneself as different." But identity politics, with its group-based rhetoric, did not initially become the mainstream position of the Democratic Party. In the 1992 campaign, Bill Clinton famously repudiated Sister Souljah, a singer and activist who had said in justification of violence in Los Angeles, "If black people kill black people every day, why not have a week and kill white people?" Said Clinton, "If you took the words white and black and you reversed them, you might think David Duke was giving that speech." At the 2004 Democratic National Convention, Barack Obama famously declared, "There is not a black America and white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America." The New Tribal Left. A decade and a half later, we are very far from Obama's America. Indeed, for today's left, group blindness is the ultimate sin, because it masks the reality of group hierarchies and oppression in America. As writer Catherine Crook puts it, America has always channeled its politics and its power through hierarchies of identity. European America acquired its land through the genocide of American Indians. It grew rich thanks to the importation and forced labor of enslaved blacks, who, on the one hand, became undeniably part of the American family through widespread sexual coercion, and on the other hand, were legally and socially excluded from the American political community for generations. In light of these realities, to insist upon a singular America is to deny the impact of violent marginalizations past and present. Progressives reject the whitewashing of the lived experiences of non-white or non-male Americans. It's indisputable that whites, and specifically white male Protestants, dominated America for most of its history, often violently, and that this legacy persists. Thus, for the left, identity politics is a means to confront rather than obscure the uglier aspects of American history and society. But in recent years, whether because of growing strength or growing frustration with the lack of progress, the left has upped the ante. A shift in tone, rhetoric, and logic has moved identity politics away from inclusion, which had always been the left's watchword, toward exclusion and division. For much of the left today, anyone who speaks in favor of group blindness is on the other side, indifferent to or even guilty of oppression. For some, especially on college campuses, anyone who doesn't swallow the anti-oppression orthodoxy hook, line, and sinker, anyone who doesn't acknowledge white supremacy in America, is a racist. When liberal icon Bernie Sanders told supporters, "It's not good enough for somebody to say, 'Hey, I am a Latina, vote for me,'" Quentin James, the National Black Americans Director for the Ready for Hillary PAC, retorted that Sanders's comments regarding identity politics suggest he may be a white supremacist too. Once identity politics gains momentum, it inevitably subdivides, giving rise to ever-proliferating group identities demanding recognition. One of the most important concepts in left academic circles today is intersectionality, which understands oppression as operating on multiple axes simultaneously. Thus, Columbia Law professor Kimberly Crenshaw, who coined the term over 25 years ago, has explored how the claims of black women were often excluded from both feminist and anti-racist movements because the experiences of black women did not reflect the typical women's experience or black experience. Similarly, political activist Linda Sarsour has pointed out that while equal pay for women is an important issue, look at the ratio of what white women get paid versus black women and Latina women. Pathbreaking in the 1990s, intersectionality has in recent years been misinterpreted and used in ways not originally intended, becoming, as Crenshaw put it in 2017, basically, identity politics on steroids, dividing people into ever more specific subgroups created by overlapping racial, ethnic, gender, and sexual orientation categories. Today, there is an ever-expanding vocabulary of identity on the left. Facebook now lists more than 50 gender designations from which users can choose, from genderqueer to intersex to pangender. Or take the acronym LGBTQ. Originally LGB, variants over the years have ranged from GLBT to LGBTI to LGBTQQIAAP, as preferred terminology shifted and identity groups quarreled about who should be included and who should come first. Because the left is always trying to out-left the last left, The result can be a zero-sum competition over which group is the least privileged, an oppression Olympics, often fragmenting progressives and setting them against each other. All these dynamics were on display at the Women's March of January 21, 2017, when a staggering 4.2 million people gathered in solidarity at events around the country, with an estimated crowd of almost 500,000 in D.C. alone. In many ways, the march was a stupendous success, an expression of progressive unity. The New Yorker reported that the crowds on Saturday were so enormous, so radiant with love and dissent, that the coming together of all marginalized groups seemed possible. Below the surface, however, political tribe tensions plagued the march. The original name of the march, the Million Woman March, was also the name of an important 1997 protest for Black women's unity. Black women quickly accused the organizers of appropriation. On Facebook, one critic wrote, "I take issue with white feminists taking the name of something that Black people started to address our struggles. That's appropriation. I will not even consider supporting this until the organizers are intersectional, original, and come up with a different name." Another critic lambasted the organizers as racist. "This is the perfect example of how white supremacy, disguised as white feminism, can be incredibly damaging to Black bodies, Black culture, and Black herstory." Acknowledging these criticisms, the organizers changed the name of the march and brought on non-white activists as co-chairs. But tensions continued. Many Black women felt used, especially in light of the glaring fact that 53% of white women had voted for Trump. Others chose not to participate in the march because they didn't want to be a part of a mass mobilization of white women. And on the march's Facebook page, one Black activist encouraged white women to assume a more passive role in the fight, to listen and learn from those who had already been engaged in the struggle. "You don't just get to join because now you're scared too. I was born scared." Shishi Rose, a Brooklyn blogger, wrote, "Now is the time for you to be listening more, talking less. You should be reading our books and understanding the roots of racism and white supremacy. You should be drowning yourselves in our poetry." Predictably, these criticisms ignited backlash from some white women, who began to feel not very welcome and didn't understand why women of color had to be so divisive. Some who had planned to fly to D.C. decided not to go. One 50-year-old South Carolinian woman, who had been excited to bring her daughters, canceled her trip after reading online posts. "This is a women's march," she said. "We're supposed to be allies in equal pay, marriage, adoption. Why is it now about white women don't understand Black women?" Others responded angrily to the organizers' online request that white women understand their privilege and acknowledge the struggle that women of color face. "Fuck you," is my immediate reaction, one white woman wrote. "You're no better than Trump voters," wrote another. Although inclusivity is presumably still the ultimate goal, the contemporary left is pointedly exclusionary. During a Black Lives Matter protest at the DNC held in Philadelphia in July 2016, a protest leader announced that this is a Black and Brown resistance march, asking white allies to appropriately take their place in the back of this march. The war on cultural appropriation is rooted in the belief that groups have exclusive rights to their own histories, symbols, and traditions. A prototypical example of cultural appropriation would be a white person wearing a sombrero and a fake mustache to a Halloween party, but some on the left today would also consider it an offensive act of privilege for, say, a straight white man to write a novel featuring a gay Latina. Transgressions are called out daily on social media. No one is immune. Beyoncé was criticized for wearing what looked like a traditional Indian bridal outfit. Amy Schumer, in turn, was criticized for making a parody of Beyoncé's Formation, a song about black female pride and empowerment. Students at Oberlin complained of a vendor's history of blurring the line between culinary diversity and cultural appropriation by modifying the recipes without respect for certain Asian countries' cuisines. And a student op-ed at Louisiana State University claimed that white women styling their eyebrows to look thicker, like a lot of ethnic women, was a prime example of the cultural appropriation in the country. Not everyone on the left is happy with the direction that identity politics has taken. Many are dismayed by the focus on cultural appropriation. As a progressive Mexican-American law student put it, if we allowed ourselves to be hurt by a costume, how could we manage the trauma of an eviction notice? He added, liberals have cried wolf too many times. If everything is racist and sexist, nothing is. When Trump, the real wolf, came along, no one listened. The New Tribal Right. Meanwhile, identity politics has seized the right, too, in an about-face from its longtime rhetoric of color blindness. Political scientist Samuel P. Huntington was a pivotal figure in this shift. His controversial 1996 bestseller, The Clash of Civilizations, framed Islamic culture as inimical to Western values. His even more controversial 2004 bestseller, Who Are We?, warned of the threat to Anglo-Protestant culture posed by large-scale Hispanic immigration. Viewed by many as shocking at the time, the us-versus-them anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant sentiments that Huntington expressed were bread and butter for conservatives on the 2016 campaign trail. Candidate Trump famously called for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States, described illegal Mexican immigrants as rapists, and referred disparagingly to an Indiana-born federal judge as Mexican, accusing the judge of having an inherent conflict of interest, rendering him unfit to preside over a suit against Trump. Making the argument that Trump used identity politics to win the White House is like shooting fish in a barrel. Michael Flynn, who served briefly as Trump's national security advisor, asserted in August 2016 that Islamism is a vicious cancer inside the body of 1.7 billion people on this planet, and it has to be excised. Senator Marco Rubio compared the war with Islam to America's war with Nazis. Even moderate Republicans like Jeb Bush advocated for a religious test to allow Christian refugees to enter the country preferentially. At the same time, we are also seeing on the right, particularly the alt-right, political tribalism directed against minorities perceived as too successful. At the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, David Duke warned a raucous crowd that the American media and the American political system are dominated by a tiny minority, the Jewish Zionist minority. Steve Bannon, Trump's former White House chief strategist, has complained that America's engineering schools are all full of people from South Asia and East Asia. They've come in here to take these jobs, while Americans can't get engineering degrees and can't get a job. Bannon has also warned, two-thirds or three-quarters of the CEOs in Silicon Valley are from South Asia or from Asia. A country is more than an economy. We're a civic society. The two-thirds or three-quarters figure asserted by Bannon is a wild exaggeration, and reminiscent of the kind of targeting of market-dominant minorities common in the developing world. This brings us to the most striking feature of today's right-wing political tribalism, the white identity politics that has mobilized around the idea of whites as an endangered, discriminated against group. In part, this development carries forward a long tradition of white tribalism in America. But white identity politics has also gotten a tremendous recent boost from the left, whose relentless berating, shaming, and bullying might have done more damage than good. One Trump voter claimed that, "Maybe I'm just so sick of being called a bigot that my anger at the authoritarian left has pushed me to support this seriously flawed man." The Democratic Party, said Bill Maher, made the white working man feel like your problems aren't real because you're mansplaining and check your privilege. You know, if your life sucks, your problems are real. When blacks blame today's whites for slavery or ask for reparations, many white Americans feel as though they are being attacked for the sins of other generations. Or consider this blog post in the American Conservative, worth quoting at length because of the light it sheds. "I'm a white guy. I'm a well-educated intellectual who enjoys small art house movies, coffee houses, and classic blues. If you didn't know any better, you'd probably mistake me for a lefty urban hipster. And yet, I find some of the alt-right stuff exerts a pull even on me, even though I'm smart and informed enough to see through it. It's seductive because I am not a person with any power or privilege, and yet I am constantly bombarded with messages telling me that I'm a cancer, I'm a problem, everything is my fault. I am very lower middle class. I've never owned a new car and do my own home repairs as much as I can to save money. I cut my own grass, wash my own dishes, buy my clothes from Walmart. I have no clue how I will ever be able to retire. But oh, brother, to hear the media tell it, I am just drowning in unearned power and privilege, and America will be a much brighter, more loving, more peaceful nation when I finally just keel over and die. Trust me, after all that, some of the alt-right stuff feels like a warm, soothing bath, a safe space, if you will. I recoil from the uglier stuff, but some of it, the, hey, white guys are actually okay, you know, be proud of yourself, white man, stuff is really very seductive, and it is only with some intellectual effort that I can resist the pull. If it's a struggle for someone like me to resist the pull, I imagine it's probably impossible for someone with less education or cultural exposure. If the left's exclusionary identity politics is ironic in light of the left's ostensible demands for inclusivity, equally ironic is the emergence of a white identity politics on the right. For decades, the right has claimed to be a bastion of individualism, a place where those who rejected the divisive identity politics of the left found a home. For this reason, conservatives typically paint the emergence of white identity as having been forced on them by the tactics of the left. As one political commentator puts it, "Most on the right still perceive racial groupings of any kind as anathema. They still view individualism as one of America's greatest strengths, and still view as disreputable political movements that organize around racial identities. At the same time, many feel that society has come to glorify all things non-white, demonize all things white, and that if they do not fight back, no one will. In short, feeling as though they are under perpetual attack for the color of their skin, many on the right have become defiant of their whiteness, allowing it into their individual politics in ways they have not for generations." At its core, the problem is simple, but fundamental. While Black Americans, Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans, Jewish Americans, and many others are allowed, indeed encouraged, to feel solidarity and take pride in their racial or ethnic identity, white Americans have, for the last several decades, been told they must never, ever do so. People want to see their own tribe as exceptional, as something to be deeply proud of. That's what the tribal instinct is all about. For decades now, non-whites in the United States have been encouraged to indulge their tribal instincts in just this way. But, at least publicly, American whites have not. On the contrary, if anything, they have been told that their white identity is something no one should take pride in. "I get it," says Christian Lander, creator of the popular satirical blog Stuff White People Like. "As a straight white male, I'm the worst thing on earth." But the tribal instinct is not so easy to suppress. As Vassar professor Hua Su put it in an Atlantic essay called The End of White America, "The result is a racial pride that dares not speak its name, and that defines itself through cultural cues instead." In combination with the profound demographic transformation now taking place in America, this suppressed urge on the part of many white Americans to feel solidarity and pride in their group identity as others are allowed to do has created an especially fraught set of tribal dynamics in the United States today. Ethno-nationalism light. In early 2017, a foreign policy headline proclaimed, "The GOP is America's party of white nationalism. Trump is an ethno-nationalist president," declared a columnist in Vice, "with Muslims, migrants from Latin America, and all non-whites now subordinate and unwelcome. White nationalism is upon us," wrote Jamel Bowie in Slate. It is a stunning and frightening fact that an openly white nationalist movement exists in America today with a prominence, or at least a brazenness, hard to imagine only a few years ago. The leader of this movement, the well-educated and articulate Richard Spencer, has gone out of his way to be incendiary, invoking Nazi symbolism, opposing interracial marriage, donning a fascist haircut, and calling for an all-white ethno-state to be achieved through ethnic cleansing. Although Spencer has said that this ethnic cleansing would be peaceful, in November 2016, he told a Washington Post reporter, "Look, maybe it will be horribly bloody and terrible. That's a possibility with everything." Many hear echoes of Spencer's rhetoric in statements from some of Trump's closest advisors, including Stephen Miller and the now-ousted Steve Bannon. And it's not just rhetoric. In February 2017, a white Navy veteran gunned down two Indian American engineers in Kansas, shouting, "Get out of my country!" A few weeks later, an Indian-born U.S. citizen was murdered right outside his home in South Carolina. And in Washington state, a white gunman shot a Sikh American in the arm, telling him, "Go back to your country, terrorist." In May 2017, a knife-wielding man yelling anti-Muslim epithets on a Portland commuter train fatally stabbed two people who tried to subdue him. In the first 3 months of 2017, mosques were targets of threats, vandalism, or arson on 35 occasions. Nevertheless, it would be absurd to attribute Spencer's white nationalist views to the half of American voters who supported Donald Trump. White nationalism of this kind would require expelling or exterminating between a third and half of America's population, and to suggest that 62 million Americans endorse this is preposterous, just more partisan vitriol. An August 2017 NPR PBS Marist poll showed that only 4% of Americans support white nationalism. Indeed, according to the Pew Foundation, a majority of Republicans, 56%, say it is neither good nor bad that in the next 25 to 30 years, African Americans, Latinos, and people of Asian descent will make up a majority of the population. But those who believe that we are in an ethno-nationalist moment in America are not entirely wrong. A kind of ethno-nationalism light is widespread among white Americans today. It does not dream of an all-white America. It opposes racism and celebrates tolerance and exalts in the image of America as a nation of immigrants. But it is nostalgic for a time when minorities were not so loud, so demanding, so numerous, a time when minorities were more grateful. This demand for gratitude is well expressed by internet sensation Tommy Lauren, the controversial 25-year-old conservative political commentator who recently became a Fox News contributor. Like many of the most visible pro-Trump female talking heads, Lauren is white, blonde, and attractive. Here's part of what Lauren said in a viral video takedown of Colin Kaepernick, the former 49ers quarterback who refused to stand for the national anthem. Colin, I support the First Amendment. I support your right to freedom of speech and expression. Go for it, bud. It's this country, the country that you have so much disdain for, that allows you the right to speak your mind. It protects your right to be a whiny, indulgent, attention-seeking crybaby. It also protects my right to shred you for it. See, the national anthem and our flag, they are not symbols of Black America, White America, Brown America, or Purple America, for that matter. There are patriots of every race that have fought and died for this country, and we honor the flag and sing the anthem as a reminder. And Colin, if this country disgusts you so much, leave. I guarantee there are thousands and thousands of people around the world that would gladly take your spot. A mind-boggling 66 million people have viewed this video. Lauren obviously resonates with huge numbers of white Americans when she criticizes minorities for blaming whites without recognizing how much America, and specifically how much white America, has done for them. Do you know how many of our ancestors fought in the Civil War to free your ancestors? Lauren has said on another occasion. The bloodiest war in U.S. history was over what was right, and it was largely white people fighting it. It is easy to see why Lauren is so popular. She celebrates America as a great, moral, and exceptional nation with a moral and exceptional constitution. She ignores everything bad that white America has ever done. She even credits whites with freeing the slaves, without mentioning who enslaved them in the first place. To ask for gratitude from minorities is to ask for a kind of subservience. Gratitude is what's owed to a benefactor. It implies a debt, while also asserting an ownership of the country's past. We built this land of opportunity and invited you in, and now we're being demonized for its imperfections. Many Americans want to celebrate the country's history and greatness without having to dredge up its racist past every single time. They want to be able to take pride in the Founding Fathers without always having to apologize for slavery, the Trail of Tears, or segregation. They love the story of America as a land of freedom and opportunity, but they are starting to fear that when minorities become a majority in America, the story will change. History books will be rewritten to depict America as a land of oppression, racism, and imperialism. Beloved classics like Little House on the Prairie and Anne of Green Gables will be banned for promulgating white supremacy. The Jefferson Memorial will be torn down, and the Oscar for Best Picture will go only to movies like 12 Years a Slave. America will be cast as a nation, in Ta-Nehisi Coates' words, of majoritarian pigs. Whites who believe that minorities hold these views of America necessarily look with anxiety on the prospect of minorities becoming a majority. Their love of country becomes tied up, even if unconsciously, with the idea of whites remaining in control of the nation's politics, culture, and identity. But how can minorities be filled with gratitude when, in their view, Americans elected a president who, as Toni Morrison puts it, questioned whether Barack Obama was born in the United States, seemed to condone the beating of a Black Lives Matter protester at a campaign rally, and made white nationalism possible again? If Lauren, with her 66 million views, is going to remind minorities of how much whites have done for them, how can minorities not respond, as Coates has, that America is a land where it is not only traditional to destroy the black body, it is heritage? We're not only in a zero-sum game, we're in a vicious circle. Is there any way out? Epilogue. Despite everything, I sense a shift in America. It could just be congenital optimism on my part, or it could be because I'm the daughter of immigrants, and my view of America will always be shaped by how they see the country and taught me to see it. But for whatever reason, I see something new happening. You'd never know it from cable news or social media, but all over the country, there are signs of people trying to cross divides and break out of their political tribes. In small town Utica, New York, Bosnian Muslims and Unitarian Christians made it a point to watch the Super Bowl together, wanting to understand one another as human beings first. Neighbors in Hackettstown, New Jersey, organized a meetup to make America relate again for everyone in the community, regardless of how you voted in the last election, to socialize in a non-politicized way. Because we are all Americans, and approaching each other with compassion is the only way we will be able to heal the deep rifts that divide us. Silicon Valley's Ro Khanna is hammering away at the tech industry to seek out talent in America's heartland, to expand operations there, and to approach the rest of the nation with more humility. Van Jones, visibly upset on election night, famously sat down for dinner with a family of Trump voters in Blue Collar, Ohio, a month later, pleading with them, "Help me understand." His CNN colleague, the African-American comedian W. Kamau Bell, books gigs at non-coastal universities like Appalachian State and actually interviewed Richard Spencer at Alabama's Auburn University for Bell's documentary series United Shades of America. The University of Minnesota has established a fellowship called Crossing the Divide for emerging journalists to travel across the country over a 3-month period with the goal of shedding light on not only the divisions that are pulling the country apart, but how communities are trying to bridge the differences. Individually, any single example will seem trivial, and it's hard to prove they represent a trend. There are certainly powerful voices opposed to conciliation, insisting, as Charles Blow has, that the Trump phenomenon is devoid of compassion and we must be closed to compromise. Nevertheless, if you look beyond the headlines and listen past the loudest partisans, you'll find something quite remarkable. All over the country, ordinary Americans are making heartfelt efforts to reach across the aisle, understand the other side, and empathize with each other's humanity. This may all seem pie in the sky, or like a band-aid for bullet wounds, but a prodigious body of evidence shows that when individuals from different groups actually get to know one another as human beings, tremendous progress can be made. This phenomenon was first analyzed by Gordon W. Allport in his 1954 book, The Nature of Prejudice. By looking at the racial integration of merchant marines, police departments, and housing projects, Allport found that face-to-face contact between members of different groups can dismantle prejudices, build common ground, and even change lives. In the last 60 years, the same basic findings have been replicated all over the world, from England to Italy to Sri Lanka, with respect to all forms of group prejudice, from ethnicity to sexual orientation to mental illness. The U.S. military may be the best example. When President Harry Truman first issued Executive Order 9981 to integrate the U.S. armed forces, popular opinion was strongly against him. Nearly two-thirds of white servicemen opposed desegregation of the military, and the American public agreed by a similar margin. Internal opposition was so widespread that the Army dragged its feet and ignored their commander-in-chief's order for as long as possible, hoping Dewey would best him in the 1948 election. Truman won, of course, and integration efforts proceeded. And in 1951, in the midst of the Korean War, researchers published a study on the effectiveness of desegregated units. To the surprise of many, they discovered that cooperation in integrated units was equal or superior to that of all white units. As Conrad Crane, director of the U.S. Army Military History Institute, recounted, "When your life depends on your buddy, the color of their skin tends to become less important. It's how good they are." This proved true in Vietnam as well. Carl Marlantis, a Marine lieutenant, recalls being on a remote jungle hilltop in Vietnam in 1968 and being asked by Ray Delgado, an 18-year-old Hispanic kid from Texas, if he wanted to try a tamale from a care package that Ray's mother had sent him. Marlantis said, "Sure," but found the tamale very tough to eat. "Lieutenant," Ray finally said, "you take the corn husk off." "I was from a logging town on the Oregon coast. I'd heard of tamales, but I'd never seen one. Until I joined my company of Marines in Vietnam, I'd never even talked to a Mexican." In Marlantis's view, not everything about the war was negative. "I saw how it threw together young men from diverse racial and ethnic backgrounds and forced them to trust one another with their lives. If I was pinned down by enemy fire and I needed an M79 man, I'd scream for Thompson, because he was the best. I didn't even think about what color Thompson was." For Marlantis and many others, the experience of interacting, living and working with members of other ethnic and racial groups had a profound effect. "White guys had to listen to soul music, and black guys had to listen to country music. We didn't fear one another, and the experience stuck with us. Hundreds of thousands of young men came home from Vietnam with different ideas about race, some for the worse, but most for the better. Racism wasn't solved in Vietnam, but I believe it was where our country finally learned that it just might be possible for us all to get along." A more recent example is the astonishing transformation in Americans' opinions about same-sex marriage. As recently as 1988, support in the United States for same-sex marriage was just 11%. Today, 62% support it. Many factors contributed to this shift, but one of the most important was simple. In 2013, 75% of Americans reported having a friend, relative, or coworker who has revealed to them that he or she is gay, up from only 24% in 1985. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, whose votes on the Supreme Court helped bring about marriage equality, described this change in a 2014 interview. "Once gay people began to say who they were," she said, "you found that it was your next-door neighbor, or it could be your child, and we found people we admired." It's crucial to emphasize that mere exposure to people from different tribes is not sufficient. On the contrary, studies show that minimal or superficial exposure to out-group members can actually worsen group division. One study by Harvard professor Ryan Enos found that simply being exposed to two men speaking Spanish on a train led commuters, most of whom were white and liberal, to have significantly more conservative attitudes on immigration. Unsurprisingly, negative interactions with people from other groups also increase group hostility. So merely putting members of different groups in the same space is not enough, and indeed can aggravate political tribalism. Instead, what is needed is one-on-one human engagement, which is hard precisely because of how divided we are. But anything worth achieving is difficult. When people from different tribes see one another as human beings who at the end of the day want the same things, kindness, dignity, security for loved ones, hearts can change. As a Coptic priest in New York put it, humility is a mediator. It will always be the shortest distance between you and another person. Speaking of distances between people, Yale University, where I've taught for 15 years, has, along with other liberal colleges, been much mocked and decried of late, and in some ways I understand why. Over the last several years, I have sometimes watched with dismay as a tiny but highly vocal handful of students use their privileged positions not to foster the free exchange of ideas, but to shame and punish, almost invariably at no cost to themselves, tearing apart the student community and driving dissenters underground, where resentment only festers. But I have also seen with my own eyes over and over the very best of America, practically miracles. I've taught a seminar where the daughter of an undocumented worker from Mexico and the son of a cop from New Hampshire started off hating each other and ended up loving each other. I've watched as a third-generation Holocaust survivor and an organizer of the anti-Israeli boycott movement struggled to understand each other, and ultimately agreed to disagree, without friendship, but without venom. Baby steps. I've seen a former Navy SEAL and a human rights activist bond over trivial pursuit. I've seen a talented black poet who spent 8 years in prison because of a carjacking he did at 16 before coming to Yale win the admiration and awe of opponents of Black Lives Matter with his grace and empathy. But even this is not enough. Remaining a supergroup requires something more. It's not enough that we view one another as fellow human beings. We need to view one another as fellow Americans. And for that, we need to collectively find a national identity capacious enough to resonate with and hold together as one people, Americans of all sorts, old and young, immigrant and native-born, urban and rural, descendants of slaves as well as descendants of slave owners. It's not clear whether this is possible in our time of rage. A political meme popular among Trump supporters during the 2016 election cycle showed European immigrants from the early 20th century with the following text overlaid. They came to take part in the American dream. European Christians built this nation. They didn't come to bitch, collect welfare, wage jihad, and replace the American Constitution with Sharia law. This is tribalism. It creates within America a virtuous us and a demonized them. To put it mildly, this vision of the American dream isn't going to be acceptable for half the country. Nor is it intended to be. But the same can be said of the other side. A progressive headline after the 2016 election read, "White working class narrative is nothing but a racist dog whistle." A widely held view. A political blog post titled, "America, Land of the Oppressed, Home of the Cowards," asserts that America is neither the land of the free nor the home of the brave. It is the land of oppression for everyone other than rich, white, Christian males. According to the filmmaker Michael Moore, the United States is a nation founded on genocide and on the backs of slaves. And Toni Morrison, one of America's most beloved novelists, wrote, "Unlike any nation in Europe, the United States holds whiteness as the unifying force." Sadly, there's a grain of truth to what Moore and Morrison say. But if America is nothing more than a land of oppression, founded on nothing more than genocide and white supremacy, it's hard to see why America is worth fighting for. Today's purveyors of political tribalism on both left and right may think they are defending American values, but in fact, they are playing with poison. America will cease to be America and will no longer be a supergroup if we define our national identity in terms of whiteness, Anglo-Protestant culture, European Christianity, or any other terms not inclusive of all religions and ethnicities. But it will also cease to be America if enough of us come to believe that our country and its ideals are a fraud. There is a world of difference between saying that America has failed to live up to its own ideals, with egregious injustice persisting today, and saying that the principles supposedly uniting us are just smokescreens to disguise oppression. The peril we face as a nation today is not only that America might fail to live up to its promise, but that Americans might stop believing in that promise or the need to fight for it. The increasing belief on the left that this promise was always a lie, or on the right that it has always been true and has already been achieved, are two sides of the same coin. A few months after the 2016 election, a student said to me one of the most remarkable things I've ever heard. Giovanni came from the humblest origins. As a child, he lived with his Mexican-American family in an old taco truck before they moved up to an $1,800 motorhome. He told me about a retired white couple from rural Louisiana, whom I'll call Walter and Leanne Jones, who lived in the same Texas trailer park as Giovanni's family. According to Giovanni, the Joneses were extremely kind from day one. "Walter helped us set up the taco truck and would bring my sister and me sweets from the local food pantry, where he volunteered to haul food with his pickup truck. Multiple Thanksgivings, Walter ensured my family had a turkey and sides to cook, which he also brought from the pantry. Walter also loved guns and made it known that he would protect us if anyone caused any trouble. There's a lot of bad people here, but I dare them to try and mess with you. They will regret it." But a decade later, during the 2016 election cycle, Giovanni realized, based on a number of social media posts made by the Joneses, that Walter and Leanne held strongly racist attitudes. In Giovanni's view, however, the Joneses exemplify a critical paradox that progressives often overlook or dismiss to their own detriment. Despite their racist attitudes toward faceless brown people generally, the Joneses treat my family with nothing but love and respect, despite our Mexican descent and immigrant status. In fact, the Joneses even consider my sister and me to be their adoptive grandkids. Furthermore, the food pantry where Walter volunteered primarily served the black community. On multiple occasions, I observed firsthand the joy it brought Walter to help these communities. I found Giovanni's story striking, first because he was talking about racism in a way that is completely taboo among progressives, a group he identifies with. Among progressives, once someone is deemed racist, that's it. You can't talk to him, you can't compromise, and you certainly can't suggest that he might be a decent person just because he's nice to a few minorities. Liberal eyes start rolling as soon as the racist mentions his black friends. I also found the story striking because of a further insight Giovanni offered. The Joneses didn't think of themselves as racists. In their minds, the countless iterations of treating minorities with decency and kindness is undeniable evidence that they are not racist. As a result, when liberals call them bigots, they feel unjustly attacked, creating a chasm of anger. When the conviction that they are morally blameless clashes with liberal outrage, it drives a wedge between elite progressives and the working-class people they ostensibly desire to help. Finally, I found the story remarkable because it reflected a generosity in scarce supply these days. In case it's not clear, the Joneses were Trump supporters, whereas Giovanni viewed Trump as a deep, visceral threat to his family and his community. Yet he was willing to reach across the tribal divide out of a belief in a shared humanity and a sense of coming from the same place, the same America. In Giovanni's case, a trailer park in Texas, where people helped one another get by. If we're to come together as a nation, we all need to elevate ourselves. We need to find a way to talk to each other if we're to have any chance of bridging divides. We need to allow ourselves to see our tribal adversaries as fellow Americans, engaged in a common enterprise. Those who are worried about terrorism should be able to express that worry without being branded an Islamophobe. Those who view America's seismic demographic changes and massive influx of immigrants with anxiety should be able to express that anxiety without being branded a racist. Transformational population change is dislocating, and diversity has costs. But we've been through this before. Over and over throughout American history, waves of new immigrants have come to our shores, always met with suspicion and fear that the nation's character will be endangered, its streets made unsafe, its values lost. Every time we've overcome this fear, prospered, and grown stronger. With every wave of immigration in the past, American freedom and openness have triumphed. Will we, telling ourselves these immigrants are different, be the weak link, the first generation to fail? Will we forget who we are? At the same time, those committed to exposing the grotesque injustices of America's past and present, they are right too, and doing us all a service. No country can be great if it can't be honest. And America, in particular, with its resounding constitutional principles, needs to be held to its own standards or fall under the weight of hypocrisy. But other generations seeking justice have done so for the promise of America. Even as James Baldwin lacerated the collection of myths to which white Americans cling, that their ancestors were all freedom-loving heroes, he made clear that his dream was to achieve our country, to make America what America must become, for great men have done great things here and will again. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote that African Americans sitting at whites-only lunch counters were standing up for the best in the American dream. At a service honoring Dr. King, President Barack Obama said of the leaders of the civil rights movement, "As much as our government and our political parties had betrayed them in the past, as much as our nation itself had betrayed its own ideals, they didn't give up on this country. Imperfect as it was, they continued to believe in the promise of democracy, in America's constant ability to remake itself, to perfect this union." In the blockbuster Broadway hit play Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda brilliantly used an all-minority cast to portray America's founding fathers. This was a radical and radically patriotic move. Hamilton doesn't deny American racism or injustice. On the contrary, the pointed casting draws attention to those historically excluded from center stage in the nation's creation and reminds us that America's ideals always far exceeded its reality. But the play is also a reminder that this country's history is built on principles that transcend their time. It